I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I mean, I've got good news. It is based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this with us, so please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations at teachersLounge@niu.edu. And today on the show, we are joined by Jason Pisha. He's the director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And the program, known as PAR, it's a 10-month master's degree for up-and-coming journalists, a sort of apprenticeship where students spend much of the time not in the classroom but in an internship doing regal journalism covering the Illinois State House. Pisha's also a professor teaching communication and media law at UIS. As you could imagine, this was a particularly fun episode for me as a journalist, talking with someone training the next generation of journalists. And we talk about what it's like for students entering an industry constantly in flux, and especially in a time when government is more openly hostile to journalism than it has been in the past. And I was really curious about what motivates students to want to become journalists in 2026, and Jason mentioned that a lot of it is about seeing government dysfunction and watching powerful people not held accountable.
Journalism is one way to address that, to question it, to maybe contribute to some solutions for that. And I think students feel a real sense of power and sense of duty to be a part of a solution, and journalism can be part of that. And I talk to a lot of students who are motivated by that.
We also dove into why he became a journalist in the first place and what it was like as a newspaper reporter when the internet blew up the business model and layoffs ripped through newsrooms like his. It's a really great conversation. But before we get to that, we've got another education story we want to share. In Illinois, both sides of the aisle want to reform how the state funds higher education. They agree that the current system is broken, but lawmakers have competing visions for what reform should look like. Depending on who you ask, Illinois is either not spending nearly enough on public universities or spending more than any state in the country.
That everybody deserves equal education.
The hundreds of students, faculty, and staff from universities across Illinois who rallied at the Capitol a few weeks ago believe there needs to be a lot more state investment. Mark Van Wienen is an English professor at Northern Illinois University and president of the Tenure and Tenure Track Union, and he was part of a busload from NIU that made the trip to Springfield to support the Adequate and Equitable Public University Funding Act. It's a higher ed funding plan proposed by Democratic lawmakers.
Our institutions have been starved of resources by the state.
When you account for inflation, state appropriations for higher ed have gone down 40% since 2002. Back then, most university revenue came from state funding. Only about 25% came from tuition and fees. And Van Wienen says now that is flipped.
The current day Husky at NIU is covering 65%.
He says you can draw a direct line from the decline of state appropriations to the skyrocketing price of tuition. And it's created a situation where it's often cheaper for Illinois students to pay out-of-state tuition somewhere else rather than attend college close to home. Everyone, Republicans and Democrats, hates this. And where they all agree is that pretty much everyone wants to change how the state funds public universities. They argue there is no system. Right now, the state just looks at what schools got last year and then gives all universities a flat increase or decrease. Republican State Representative Jeff Kiker says the current system rewards failing schools. He just introduced his own higher ed reform bill to build a 10-year sustainability plan for state universities. And he argues it doesn't make sense if one university loses students and another gains them that they both get the same increase.
So they're getting significantly less per student than they did before. And it's almost a disincentive to enroll additional students because you're not getting the money you need.
The other side says the current system's broken because it doesn't weigh factors like how many low-income students schools serve and which have larger endowments. A state commission's report, which is the basis of the equitable funding bill, found that no public universities are getting enough money to support their students. But as Van Wienen says, some are much closer than others.
this commission determined that NIU is at approximately 56% of adequacy.
It found that the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign has 92% of the funding it needs. And Van Wienit says it's a reason why, while most public universities like NIU have seen steep enrollment declines over the past few decades, the University of Illinois system keeps setting enrollment records. The Equitable Funding Plan wants to fix that by pouring hundreds of millions of extra dollars into universities, prioritizing the schools furthest away from adequate funding. And although most Illinois public universities support this plan, the University of Illinois system doesn't. They say it would lead to tuition increases for them. Elaine Gabrick is the director of policy analysis at the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. It's a nonprofit research group that supports the Equitable Funding Plan. And Gabrick says no universities, including U of I, would ever receive less money than they do right now under the Equitable Plan.
Yes, they receive a smaller portion of those new funds that would go through the formula. But when you look at how far away certain other universities in the state are from what they need to successfully serve their students, that just makes sense.
But Republican Representative Jeff Kiker says that state funding should strengthen the schools and the programs that students are choosing.
The dollars to the university should follow the student. So that should be the state support, and that should also be the tuition support.
But remember when I said that some people argue Illinois actually spends the most on higher ed? That's a point Kiker makes. Illinois' higher ed spending per full-time student is the highest in the country.
Throwing more money at them through this, it's going to create actually a bigger need for more state income tax and revenue.
So how can Illinois be spending the most and not spending nearly enough? Can both of those things be true at the same time? Well, Elaine Gabrick says, yeah, actually it can.
That does not take into account, first of all, the payment to the state university retirement system. So in FY 2025, that was about $2.2 billion. So just to put things into perspective, that's 43% of total state funds.
Basically, she says a lot of state higher ed money isn't actually going to students. It's paying for pensions, mostly pension debt service. But even if you remove pension money from that equation, Gabrick says Illinois is still above average when it comes to spending per full-time student. But she believes it's even more complicated because of another issue. Illinois public universities have over $8 billion worth of deferred maintenance.
It's hard to say exactly how much this has affected the appropriations per student.
So since Kiker doesn't think universities are underfunded, why is it that enrollment's dropping so far at some schools and not at others? He says there are a lot of factors that play into this, and it would be a big question for his commission to explore. And he's also deeply concerned about the looming enrollment cliff hitting universities across the country.
You're going to look at a third fewer students. There aren't as many people that are coming through the system. So if we don't right size now and we continue to do this, we are going to pull down all of the Illinois higher education institutions by trying to save them all.
He says the state should at least consider radical change. And that could be downsizing some campuses. He says maybe struggling schools could attract talent by specializing in the trades or fine arts.
Failure tomorrow is quickly arriving. And if we don't do it now, we're going to be in a real big world of hurt within the next 5 years.
Again, NIU's Mark Van Wienen.
It is an offense that legislators blame our institutions for declines in enrollment when they are the ones who have under-resourced our institutions.
And he says that, ironically, the universities lacking the most resources are also the ones best equipped to serve the students failed by the current status quo. All right, well, without any further ado, let's just jump right into my conversation with the director of the University of Illinois Springfield's Public Affairs Reporting Program, Jason Pisha. We start off with Jason telling us about what his PAR students are up to at the end of the school year.
For their final project, they produced a talk show about legislative issues that are going on at the State House. So I give them practice like working on a microphone and answering questions from panelists and, you know, stuff like that, because, they're going to get called to do that, I'm sure, over their careers. So
are most of the folks in that program like pretty much coming out of an undergrad program or early career folks, or do you get folks from various points in their career that they come to PAR, or what does that look like?
Yeah, it's a little bit all over the place. I'd say about 60% are coming straight out of undergraduate, where they maybe worked for a campus news organization or had an internship at their campus's NPR station or something like that. And they're a journalism major, so they have some good experience coming in. But yeah, then I get some early career journalists who maybe been in the business for 1, 2, 3, 4 years and just looking, you know, they've been in a smaller market and they're looking to, you know, upgrade their resume and level up their chances of getting a job in a bigger market. So they come here. And then I have others who have, total career change. You know, they've worked in the legal profession or worked in some other area, or they had an interest in political science and but never done journalism, but now want to do journalism. So we'll help with that too.
Oh, that's fun. That's got to be extra exciting for people that come in from a more non-traditional route.
Yeah, we got to do a lot of work in the fall semester to get them up to speed on news writing skills before we throw them into an internship at the State House, but it works.
Yeah, for sure. But again, you get to, you know, again, talk about journalism and talk about the industry and how we consume media and all that with people who are, again, thinking about going into this, or, you know, want to do this professionally, have done this professionally before in a lot of cases. And then also just kind of your general undergraduate students who are taking some media or communications courses. So you get to see kind of the full spectrum of how different that conversation can be and, you know, where students come at things differently has got to be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I get students who, you know, the intro to mass media course that I teach, for example, all, you know, comm majors have to take that, but others can take it too. So, you know, that course basically goes over the history of all different forms of media, newspapers, radio, television, video games, internet, social media. So they kind of hit on everything and kind of learn what they're interested in, you know, advertising, public relations, and what they're not interested in, and maybe develop a career path from that course. So that's a little bit interesting too.
Yeah. And like we all consume media, and I think all of us, or at least a lot of us, have like real and sometimes like strong opinions about these types of things. I was curious if you guys have had, again, in either the PAR setting or in just other classes that you're teaching, any really good conversations in class, you know, somewhat recently that you could talk about?
Sure. I mean, especially my media law class this semester, you know, I typically start each class session by looking at something that's in the news like that week or even that day. And when it comes to like a First Amendment question or a free press issue, and, you know, goodness knows there's been a ton of those stories lately. And when we look to, you know, what's happening with the Trump administration and other aspects of government on what they're doing to, you know, curtail or undermine the press or attack the press. And, you know, what rights do we have as media members to call out politicians who are doing or saying questionable things, and how we need to stand up for those rights. So, yeah, we get a lot of good conversations about, you know, the media's role and, you know, how we as just average people who do this job of journalism on a daily basis have the ability to, you know, kind of confront these high powered politicians and ask them questions about what they're doing and make them be accountable for the decisions that they're making. And it's a little bit eye-opening to some of the newer students who, you know, maybe are accustomed to being told what to do and, you know, being told to, you know, just bow down to power. But you know, this is different.
Yeah. Before we get super deep into it too, I want to, again, for people that just are not familiar with the public affairs reporting program, can we just, again, give kind of the broad strokes of kind of what the program looks like for students who are going into it?
Yeah, so public affairs reporting, it's a 10-month master's degree program here at the University of Illinois Springfield. It's one of the original programs to the university when we opened in the early 70s. We've been around since the fall of 1972, so that makes us 54 years old, which is crazy. Founded by former U.S. Senator Paul Simon. He had lost an election for lieutenant governor here and joined the faculty at what was then Sangamon State University. And he was a former newspaper man himself, owned a newspaper in Southern Illinois, and decided that, you know, we needed people who understood government and then could write about it and broadcast about it and tell other people about it to help them understand. So he got this program started. It's a little bit unique in that a lot of academic journalism programs Many of them will create their own new service, sort of a student new service that's the editor is a faculty member, and they'll create a bunch of stories and, you know, kind of like a wire service that other outlets can use those stories. But we partner directly with news organizations around the state for our interns to work directly with them. So they're working alongside professional reporters and editors who do that as a full-time job. And then they get their stories and their broadcasts on, you know, professional newspapers and radio stations and TV stations. So, you know, they get some really great experience. But yeah, like I said, we've been around for 50 years. And, you know, the first semester they spend in the classroom taking some journalism writing classes and stories on Illinois policy. And then we throw them into an internship into the deep end. And they start reporting on government and politics going on at the State House with their internship placement. And they do that through the end of June as the legislature goes home for the summer. And then they're out of here. They're out of here in 10 months and they have a master's degree and a ton of great experience and a ton of great work samples that they can show to an employer and prove that, you know, they can hit the ground running at whatever government beat they get put into and whatever market they go and work for.
Do you describe it or see it as an apprenticeship type program, again, where it's less than a year? A lot of it's that direct work-based experience, which, again, it's just fascinating to have that kind of apprenticeship in an industry that is constantly evolving.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, many graduate programs, there's a lot of academic work that you do. You write a thesis and you many times spend 2 years doing it. You know, Sangamon State University and now UAS was actually founded on the premise of getting college credit for actually doing stuff. And that's sort of been the hallmark of the PAR program. The students earn about, you know, 40% of their college credits toward their degree by actually being a real reporter out in the field instead of, you know, sitting in a class. So I think that's a big advantage. We don't require a thesis. Instead, they pull together the best journalism work they've done over their internship as proof that they've mastered public affairs reporting. So yeah, it's a good situation. They learn a lot. They get their hands dirty doing it, and it's pretty affordable as well. We like to think, even in today's college market and how much tuition is all over the place. But we think it's a good deal, and we hope lots of people find out about it.
Yeah, I don't know if you feel like you had a similar experience, but you know, I felt like when I was in college, and you know, it wasn't until the last 2 years, because I went to a community college. I was not doing journalism specific things there. It wasn't until I transferred those last 2 years that I was like really involved with student run media, like we were describing before, of like, again, doing stories about our local campus and that type of thing. I felt like that so like helped so much to prepare me for going into the field, that like actual kind of on the job experience. And that, you know, I think that there are obviously tons of jobs that are like this, that you really can only talk about it theoretically for so long if you want to do it. And the only way to get better at it is to actually do the thing. But journalism is definitely one of those things that I feel like you really can only improve on by doing it.
Yeah, learning by doing it. It's definitely, yeah, I felt the same way when I went through college myself. You know, I learned a ton in my classes, but yeah, working for the student newspaper when I worked at Illinois State University, the Vidette, you know, just spending long hours there covering real news and getting a newspaper out every night. I mean, those are lessons I still use to this moment. So, yeah, it's, I could tell you a few things what I learned in classes back then, but it's the experiences that stick with you.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's interesting because, like, you know, people talk about how, again, I mentioned like, oh, the journalism industry is evolving so much, journalism's so tumultuous to get into, which I'm like, I'm 30 years old. Journalism has been in a tumultuous place at least my entire life. So like, call me when it's a stable time for the media or for journalism. But like, so you have the industry and you have technology that's evolving so much, but the like kind of need for reliable journalists, for, you know, trained journalists, obviously is still the same. Like, we still really need those. But I imagine that with something like PAR, with technology and so much that's evolving that way, that I would imagine that's the primary way that the program evolves. Or have you seen it, again, since you also went through this program 20 plus years ago now, when you compare your experience that you had as a student to your experience leading it now, Is it mainly a change in just technology and tools, or is there some philosophical changes as well?
I think yes to both. I mean, obviously the tools have changed. In some ways, they haven't changed. I mean, I think the main thing we teach is just clear, solid, factual, fair writing about government. You need to be a good writer. You need to be able to understand what's going on. And you need to be able to interpret it in such a way that an average person in the audience is going to understand it. And that skill hasn't changed since the 1970s, that need for that skill. So in that way, I think it's everything's pretty constant. And we continue to push that and focus on that and not let too much of the technology get in the way of that. But, I mean, we're telling stories by video. We're telling stories with data visualization. We're telling stories with social media, and those tools are all in there. But I think at the core, at the base of all that is just a desire and a skill to be able to tell those stories in an understandable way. And then, yeah, just the philosophy itself of journalism. It's just important that, you know, students know that they need to, you know, be accurate with what they say. You know, we've reached a point to where, you know, there's half of the audience out there that doesn't believe what we say just because we say we're journalists. That's a different dynamic than what it once was. I mean, journalists have never been the most loved industry in the universe, but I think we're maybe at a low point in terms of being loved by everyone. So, you know, we have to just be sure about what we say and triple check our facts and, you know, stand by our reporting if there's questions about it. And just don't do anything, whether it's real or perceived, that's going to call into question your integrity, your truthfulness, your ability to tell a good story. Those are things we have to think about now that maybe we thought about a little less, maybe we took for granted as journalists in the past.
Right. That just kind of the democratization of information people have, you know, even if 30 years ago they might have not liked or had criticisms of their local newspaper, their local TV station, there just weren't very many games in town. And so now, you know, you can go to 1,000 other places for what you feel like is information, even if it's not vetted journalism, even if they're doing a different thing, right? Like, it's just such a vastly different landscape in a way that I think is so fascinating. And the way that in journalism, I remember in college having these conversations about like journalistic objectivity and what does that even mean? If we're all people and we have our own perspective, we all have our biases and the things that, you know, our own experiences that we come at stories and naturally gravitate towards certain things or ask particular types of questions, that I think that like what we really maybe mean by that is like fairness, is accuracy even. But I do feel like, yeah, when you talk about like trust, that just like understanding how it works can actually go, I think, a pretty long way towards helping people grapple with that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, another thing we have to sort of instill in today's students as well. I mean, a lot of today's students have grown up in a world of social media, which is a very opinion and viewpoint heavy medium. I mean, they're getting, you know, maybe less facts and more about what people think about what they think are facts. And I think we've developed maybe a culture now where everybody is opinionated about everything and they feel very strongly about things. And definitely me, when I went through college, and probably you as well, I mean, you learned how you needed to maybe separate yourself from the story. And, you know, you might feel passionate about an issue, but definitely keep yourself out of the story and don't let on to anyone how you feel about a topic one way or another. You know, we have students these days where, you know, they do feel strongly about a topic and aren't afraid to express their opinions either on their own personal social media or, you know, maybe it seeps into their writing as well. So that's the thing I got to watch for, is to, you know, make sure their stories remain accurate and fair and they keep their own feelings out of them, but also realizing that they're human beings and they're allowed to feel things and they're allowed to believe things. It's just sort of channeling those feelings and beliefs into journalism that's productive. I mean, you can advocate for what you believe in and what you feel strongly about by doing solid, fair journalism about it. Ask important questions, and get people to go on the record with solid, trustworthy answers, and you know, address the issue that way instead of speaking out for yourself.
Yeah, you know, I think it's fascinating too on social media that like people generally seem to trust individuals often more than they trust like institutions that they might see as like kind of faceless or nameless in that way. You know, we've been doing a lot more kind of forward-facing vertical video for social media where it's not me expressing my opinion. It's just me talking about my reporting in a different platform, right? Like me doing it in a video for Facebook or Instagram or for TikTok and all that type of things. And the thing I think is so fascinating about that too is that like we think of that and we describe that as like a way to cater to younger audiences. But what we've found is that like, it's actually just like what the platforms reward now. And so like my 92-year-old grandmother, if she's going to like mention any of my reporting to me, any of my work, it's going to be because she saw a video forward of my face looking at a camera talking about my journalism. And again, it's like, it's just kind of how everyone consumes journalism or everyone consumes content writ large now.
It's, translates to the national media as well. I mean, we hear in the news now about, you know, CBS News and, you know, do we trust them anymore given, you know, who they put in at the top of that organization? And, you know, there's feelings about decisions that they make as an organization, but there's individual journalists at CBS News that I respect and I trust, and I can watch them on TV and not have any qualms about their stories. And it can even go as far as a partisan news network, like a Fox News, for example. As a whole, people might love it or hate it, but there's those individual journalists as well that sort of put their own touch on it. And you can feel differently about them just because we could trust a face more than we can trust a corporation.
Right. Well, and again, as we're talking about kind of more journalism on different platforms, journalism on social media, different platforms that people are seeing it, like for you guys, you know, your internships that you're putting students in, you know, you guys are partnering directly with, you know, media outlets. Again, that's public radio stations, that's newspapers. I assume that's also like online only publications at this point. Have you guys had any like, oh, you're going to intern for a hyper-local Facebook page or for a podcast or for a YouTube channel yet? Or is that something that hasn't happened quite yet?
It hasn't happened quite yet. I think the closest we get is Capital News Illinois, which is, the nonprofit wire service that covers the State House pretty intently. They don't have a publication per se, but they do put out their stories as a wire service, and many newspapers pick those up. But they do most of their own story distribution through the web. But otherwise, our internships are maybe more traditional: Tribune, Chicago Tribune, Sun-Times. We have four NPR stations: Chicago, Springfield, Champaign, and Bloomington/Peoria. And then a TV station as well, WCIA, over in Champaign, has a full-time Springfield bureau person here that takes one of our students. So then we've had Daily Herald in the suburbs and other TV stations as well. So we have a lot of solid partners who work with us and know us. And I assume at some point I'm going to get approached by a hyper-local Facebook page or a YouTube channel or a TikTok channel that is taken on. They've decided they want to cover State House news and would like an intern. And I'm totally open to talking to them about that, as long as they can provide a good experience and be a good mentor and provide good coaching and oversight to the intern. I'll send an intern anywhere.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, again, I'm sure when you were in the program and you imagined your future in journalism and kind of what the pinnacle of that profession was. I feel like for a lot of people, it was kind of the big names, whether it be the Chicago Tribune or the New York Times or something like that. And so when you imagined your future, you imagined it, you know, working for a newspaper or a TV station or whatever you were particularly interested in. I feel like for me, when I was in college, it was a lot of that still, but then with some slight tweaks where it might be like, you know, one of the things that got me interested in journalism in the first place was the NPR Politics podcast, right? So it's still kind of traditional media, NPR, but a slightly different format. So when you're talking with students right now who are coming in, how are they imagining their future in journalism? Are they thinking about kind of more of the traditional publications that we have? Are they thinking about like being independent creators? I'm sure it's a mix like anything.
Yeah, I think generally, you know, for as much as we like to think the world has evolved to a place we can't imagine anymore, a lot of our students come in hoping that they can intern with the Chicago Tribune because that's a name, or hoping they can intern with the Sun-Times because, you know, that's a well-known name of a media organization, and people make pretty good money there and they get a lot of exposure there, and it's in big city. And so I feel like a lot of our students still want that traditional experience just because of maybe the
prestige that comes with that kind of institutional prestige. Yeah,
definitely the word I was going to use, the prestige that goes along with working at a big name like that. But you know, who knows, 5-10 years from now, the podcaster or a YouTube channel may become just as popular as the Chicago Tribune, and people will be fighting to get that internship more than anything. So we'll see where it goes, and we'll evolve as we need to.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned that was like 2015, 2016-ish. The NPR Politics podcast was something that got me really interested in potentially pursuing journalism. And I felt like it's very much of that moment, you know, audio-only podcasts analyzing news. And the host then was Sam Sanders, and like had a very specific way of like bringing like real like empathy and emotion to that type of news coverage, where you felt like it was, again, like a real human being that also worked in a job covering the news. And so, again, I think about that. That's fascinating that, like, again, now the way that people are consuming journalism, consuming media is a bit different even than it was 10 years ago. But I'm curious if you have any opportunities to have conversation with students about what is bringing them into journalism, like what attracted them initially into the field. If it is, again, just like reading some of those, you know, prestigious publications and seeing that work as they were growing up, like in the chances that you've got to talk with students about like why journalism, what do you hear?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is a response to just the tough spot that journalism has been in, and the potential for what good it can do. I think, you know, there's been a lot of frustration with government at all levels, not just federal or state or local. And, you know, journalism is one way to address that, to question it, to maybe contribute to some solutions for that. And I think students feel a real sense of power and sense of duty to be a part of a solution, and journalism can be part of that. And I you know, I talk to a lot of students who are motivated by that. I mean, they understand, and we all know journalism isn't the greatest paying gig in the world. And
you what?
Know,
you don't,
yeah. Newsflash for everyone.
Breaking news.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not necessarily the most prestigious thing either, depending on, you know, where you end up working and or, you know, what the reputation of your news organization is in your community. But still, there's the ability to like ask important people tough questions. I think there's a certain sense of empowerment that goes along with that. That's pretty motivating.
Yeah. Again, I think that's something that too, as technology changes, whatever, that still feels somewhat constant, right? That like leaders can feel unaccountable, or, you know, like there are only certain ways that you can speak that truth to power, and that journalism, whatever that ends up looking like, if that's on, you know, again, if that's on TikTok or if it's in the pages of the Chicago Tribune, right? Like that is still a motivator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, people feel like, you know, it's their name on the top of it, and, you know, they can just be little unknown person, but they can make a big splash with what they do. And, you know, they feel, you know, there's some power there. It's interesting. One of my other jobs here at UIS is just recently that I took on as the advisor for the student newspaper here at UIS. We had a person leave that job and unexpectedly at the beginning of the semester. So I stepped in and, you know, it's been an online publication since COVID, but we had a goal this year of sort of at least making one big print edition at the end of the year, sort of a, you know, year wrap up situation. And, you know, a lot of the students were very confused about what we were doing. They just didn't really understand the concept of what a newspaper is or how it works. But I guided them through it. I've done it for a little while. And the newspaper actually came out this week. And it's pretty interesting to see the reaction of, you know, the students are seeing their name in print. And they feel, you know, a sense of pride and power in that. And the, you know, their name is out there and people are reading it and churning the pages and seeing what they have to say. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of an addictive quality to that. That's, I think that's why you and I are still doing this for a living, and getting at it after every day. So, and we hope that those feelings rub off on all the students we come in contact with.
There really is just some kind of, there's still something about seeing your name in print, and maybe it's because for some people it feels like an older format where it feels somewhat more prestigious too, that seeing your name in print just feels, I think, important still.
Yeah. A lot of people will say, the death of print is coming, and in some ways it already has. A lot of newspapers have cut back on how many print editions they put out on a week or a day, but yeah, there is a sense of power and legitimacy with that. That's, the newspaper, it lasts, it sits around forever, as opposed to, a online item that you'll scroll by and probably never look at again. So
we mentioned again a bit about how, you were in this program 20 plus years ago. You came and took it. It was 2019 that you started?
This job, yes.
Yep. This job? I'm curious, again, we can get into that a little bit, but I talked about what is it that motivated people to get into journalism in the first place? Can I turn it on you? Like, years ago, what was it for you that got you interested in journalism?
Yeah, so I grew up actually a little bit closer to you. I'm in from the La Salle, Peru area. So just like an hour south of you there in DeKalb.
Yeah, and I grew up in Sandwich, so even closer.
Okay, yeah.
In La Salle County.
Going to the Sandwich Fair as a kid. So we can talk about that later. But I was always a nosy kid. I like, nosing around. What were my parents talking about? What's that bill on the table? What's going on at school? Why are they talking behind closed doors? I'd always be asking questions and usually getting in trouble and telling me to mind my own business. And then living where I did, the TV news we got was from Chicago. So, number three market in the world for TV. And, you see the best of the best journalists doing very important stories and just covering big city news. And it was very inspiring to me. I wanted to be a part of that. So, I kind of never did anything with journalism until I got to college, till I got to Illinois Valley Community College. I started working for the campus paper and covering sports a little bit. And, like I said, I got hooked on seeing your name in print and, being able to say what I wanted to say in my stories and take on the topics that I wanted to take on. And it was a little bit liberating and a little bit freeing, and it felt really good. And so I decided to pursue it as a career, as I went down to Illinois State University to continue, and then continued on here. And here I am, so many years later now, teaching people how to do it.
Do you remember any of those early stories from when you were in college?
Oh yeah. it seems benign now, but, and it wasn't a news story, it was an opinion column. I was the sports editor at the time, and the softball field at our college was just in horrible condition. It was a rickety old fence. The grass wasn't cut. The base cutouts were not good. It was hard to slide. It was just a very poor field. And I wrote a column about how this is definitely not college softball material. This looks bad for the college and, is rough on the team and doesn't, I wrote a column about and sort of, went with it. The team members were very thankful. The coach was thankful. I got a lot of good feedback. And, within a year or so, I think they actually made some good improvements to the field. And I'm sure my little column didn't totally make that happen, but asking questions about it and calling it into question and asking important people, how come the baseball field looks like this and the softball field looks like this? It's again, addicting and empowering and, makes you want to do more.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't think that's benign at all. I think that's that is real change in the community. Like that, as much as seeing your name in print is really fun and empowering. Like, again, even if you can't be like, okay, draw a direct line between that column and changes that were made a year or two later, that is still something that is so motivating.
Yeah, and it was just nice to get some good recognition for the team, especially, and again, this was 30 some years ago. The thought of parity between men's and women's sports was not thought of as clearly as we think about it now and see it happening now. And there's still deficiencies in that area as well these days, but it was even, more stark back then. So,
and then you spent most of your career at the State Journal Register, and you started there would have been in the late 90s, right?
Yeah, actually, I went straight from my PAR internship was with Copley News Service, and one of their clients was the State Journal Register. So a lot of my stories that I was doing in my internship were showing up in that newspaper. And so a job opened up just at the right time. So I just kind of transferred over to the main office full time and started there in the summer of 98 as I was exiting PAR, and I was a reporter. And then in the mid 2000s, they decided the internet was going to continue being a thing in journalism. So they made me the online editor, and then I was digital editor. And then I ended my time there as the managing editor, sort of the number two person in the newsroom, sort of running the day-to-day show of what we covered and everything like that.
Right. Well, the internet is a fascinating part about that conversation, right? That like when you were starting in the late 90s, kind of nascent internet, was that a big conversation in PAR or earlier in your career about like the impact of the internet on like news consumption and production?
Yes. And no one knew how to handle it. And I'm maybe convinced that maybe we still don't know how to handle it perfectly. But I mean, there was a rush to, you know, we wanted as many clicks as we wanted. So, you know, newspapers made maybe ill-advised decisions to put all their stuff out there for free. And then, you know, then we realized people just stopped reading the print edition altogether. And then we needed to find a way to convince people to, you know, start paying for the free website that we've been giving them for all this time. And so it's been a, you know, an economic and cultural change of how we, you know, the news has value and we need to pay for it. So it's been tough to figure out, but yeah, like we're getting there, but still a while to go.
And again, everything changes so constantly that it's impossible to make any kind of future prediction about like, oh, in 10 years, the media landscape is going to look like that. That just seems like such a fool's errand. And maybe it always has been, at least from that period. But again, like, you got to really watch that entire landscape shift under your feet during your time in the newspaper industry. And like that specific part of the media too, right? Like print and newspapers felt like it got hit the hardest for sure, you know, by all these changes too, right? I think that the numbers from a couple of years ago from the research at Northwestern was something like almost 90%, like Illinois lost almost 90% of its newspapers reporters over the past 20 years. Like, I think it's from 2005 to like 2023. Like, who knows? That was a couple of years ago. Those numbers might even be more now, but you got to kind of literally see that in real time as someone who is working as a reporter. Like, how do you think about that experience now as someone who's, you know, again, like teaching the future of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. I lived through it. I lived through many rounds of layoffs in my own newsroom and saw a lot of people have to end their careers when they weren't quite ready to do so yet. And it was heartbreaking. And, you know, it just underscored the, you know, the financial realities of what we were dealing with and the changes that the internet brought on that, you know, the newspaper industry wasn't ready to respond to economically in the right way. But yeah, and now I'm, you know, encouraging people and teaching students to go into this industry. So, you know, sometimes I feel like, you know, how can I look at them with a straight face and tell them that it's all going to be okay? But, you know, I feel like I can. One good thing, if you can call it good, about all the changes that have happened is younger journalists who are just coming out of school or have a few years of experience have an easier pathway to, you know, a trajectory in a higher position in journalism than they once did. You know, back when I first started, you know, people were senior reporters and editors, and they worked at the newspaper for 20, 25, 30 years. Now it's happening in many, much fewer years. There's a downside to that, of course, you know, less institutional knowledge and experience going into these high-level positions. But these are good opportunities for, you know, young people to get into important jobs a lot quicker. And we need that younger demographic anyway, sort of leading how we cover the news and how we present it and what we choose to cover. Because, you know, this is the generation that we're trying to capture to make them reliant on what we produce. So it's important that those voices are at the table and have some power and are able to make some of those decisions.
Right. And I think it says a lot about the job, too, that you can tell people what the reality of the industry looks like and be honest with them and people to be like, yeah, it's that important that I need to keep doing it. You know, again, I remember actually when I was in college, my dad's friend, who, again, not connected to the media industry at all, but just, you know, kind of just aware of how things had been going, was like, you know, maybe I think that you should maybe talk to Peter. Like, maybe he should try something else. Like, the future of the industry, it doesn't seem like a stable career path. And to his credit, my dad, I didn't find out about that conversation until I was like several years into my career, like way after college. And I'm like, I'm grateful that he didn't try to talk me out of it at the time. But I don't know if I could have blamed him if he did, right? But that's such a real thing that you have to talk to people about when they're going into this industry, that even if you can't be like, I guarantee this is going to be the most stable job in America. Like, we also kind of don't know that about any career path. Like, 10 years ago when I was in college, everyone was saying that about computer programming, and now that feels like a very unsettled career. So again, like, planning for the future in a lot of ways feels difficult, but that stuff is real too for people going into it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, at least for me, it, you know, I think anything I come in contact with now is, you know, a piece of cake compared to my time in journalism, but the things that I've survived. You know, I work in the university setting now, and, you know, it has its own set of challenges in terms of stability and, you know, economics and, you know, financial issues. And
sure.
You know, and when those topics come up here, it's like, oh, yeah, I mean, I dealt with that 20 years ago at the newspaper level. It's finally making its way to college campuses. So here's the things we did. Here's how we coped, and here's how we move forward.
Did you ever have a moment, you know, again, during those years, during those layoffs, where you're like, maybe I should try something else?
Sure. I mean, I even went as far as, I had a few job interviews in the government world, you know, public affairs, you know, spokesperson type job, which is you know, usually a typical off ramp that a lot of journalists will take to move on to the next chapter of their careers. But, you know, it just didn't work out. And, you know,
and in some ways it did work out.
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. And I feel like I always had trouble. I still do. I have trouble taking a side on things. I'm very non-committal. I'm like, you know, there's the musical Hamilton, and Aaron Burr talks about how he, you know, doesn't want to take a side on anything. And I feel like an Aaron Burr a lot, where, you know, I've just been conditioned over all these years to sort of accept both sides. And I think if you go to work in government, you have to pick a team and stick with them and be loyal to them. And that's always been difficult for me. So journalism is a good spot for me. I'm able to sort of observe things from the sideline and understand both sides, and then try to present it in an understandable way, so people on, you know, the opposite sides can see where the other side's coming from.
What led you to this job then?
Yeah, I mean, I've always known I wanted to get into teaching. I think there's a lot of things I liked about my job at the State Journal Register, but one of them was when I got to train the staff on like a new thought piece of software or a new reporting technique, or, you know, we got video cameras in the newsroom for the first time in the mid 2000s, and here's how you use them, and here's how we upload the stuff. And I always like being that teacher. So this particular job that I have now does not come open very often. I mentioned this program's been around for 54 years. I'm only the fourth director in program history. So the previous guy, Charlie Wheeler, was a legend at the Sun-Times, and he had this job for like 26 years before I did. He was in like 1993 on. So like I said, this job doesn't come open very often. When I heard he was retiring, I had to put my name in just to try. I wasn't 100% ready to leave the newspaper industry yet. I wouldn't have been heartbroken if I didn't get this job, although I'm not sure how much longer that job would have lasted in the newspaper industry, just with the things that they're doing at the editor level and trying to slim things down. But yeah, it's the job came open, and here I am. So, and like I said, just four directors. Paul Simon did it for a couple of years. A guy named Bill Miller, who was in radio for many years, did it for 20 some years. Then Charlie did it for 26, and I'm in year 7 now. So,
oh, wow.
Long history and a short list.
Right. And like you said, you had had some of that experience training people in the newsroom like that. I was curious, do you feel like, is it a different kind of satisfaction of the work of doing this versus being a reporter?
Yeah. I mean, an objective of a career, I think, is just to make your mark and maybe, you know, spread your influence around a little more widely. And I think I get to do that now. You know, I'm teaching a handful of students every year, and they go out and do great things in the journalism industry and, you know, multiply that year by year. You know, and there's, you know, a little bit of me maybe in some of all those reporters, very little bit. A lot of it's all driven by their own talent and ambition. But a little bit of my influence that's, you know, sprinkled or infecting newsrooms around the country. So
every once in a while you see a turn of phrase and you're like, wait a minute, that sounds like me.
I put them onto that. That's good. So, but yeah, it feels good to see that your influence is trickling out a little bit more wider than maybe what you did with your small staff at your newspaper.
Do you ever get the chance to do any reporting these days? I've seen that you have some opportunities to do some commentary, do some analysis these days.
Yeah, that's the extent of it at the moment. I'm looking for opportunities to do some more work. I did some work last year on some studies on media literacy and sort of the effects of that new law, that new-ish law that Illinois has to require it.
That's what I was going to ask about next, Jason.
Yeah, we'll get into it. Do you get taught about high school, for that to be taught in high schools? And we did a little in-house survey about that and wrote an article about that. I've published a book chapter and do some article. But yeah, I do a lot of, I'm on TV shows and things talking about what's going on in Springfield. And that's a pretty useful service, I think, that people need around the state to figure out what's going on. So I keep my hand in it a little bit.
When you're doing that type of commentary and analysis, do you have to shed a little bit of the Aaron Burrish tendencies that you have there? Do you kind of have to land, or are you able to do the analysis from a way that you feel like is still, you know, kind of balanced and still the perspective that you've had?
Yeah, I'm still balanced. You know, it's one thing, like I said, I mentioned I had my students do a talk show as part of their semester ending project here. And that's one of the things we teach them. I mean, sometimes you get pinned into those shows. I'm like, what do you think about this? Do you think this is going to pass? But yeah, I've gotten pretty good at sort of deferring that and just sort of presenting the facts and saying, well, there's people on this side that say this, but there's people on this other side that say the opposite. So we're going to see, you know, which side wins out, and sort of, I'm just the reporter. And I'm still pretty good at keeping my opinion out of it. I mean, the last time I was on the show, the topic of the faculty strike here at UIS came up, and you know, I'm sort of sitting in the middle of it, and I suppose I could have taken a side, but again, I kind of gave the disclaimer of, you know, this is where I work and this is where I sit, but here's what the union's saying, here's what the administration is saying, and they're at a standstill, and we're going to see where this goes. So I feel like I kept it down the middle. I didn't show my hand.
Yeah. Like we teased that you recently worked on this kind of survey report about media literacy in Illinois. And for people that don't know, about 4 years ago now, the state became one of the first in the country to pass this bill requiring high schools to teach a unit of instruction on media literacy, which this is an audio program, so people don't know the invisible air quotes that I put around unit of instruction, because it's something as an education reporter I always think is funny, because we actually don't have a definition of what that means. So like what a unit of instruction looks like can be very, very different from school to school. And your survey was, again, looking at how this media literacy instruction does seem to look different depending on, you know, in terms of how long schools teach this, in terms of in what classes, maybe even what they're focused on. But I was curious what you learned from that survey, because it's been something that I remember reporting on at the time and something I have been wanting to follow up on since, to be like, what does this look like, and how do we know if it's working or not?
Yeah, it's you know, like I said, I also give the air quotes around unit of instruction. It's a very vague term, written vaguely on purpose.
Sure.
You know, there's, you know, political backlash if, you know, big old bad state government is starting to overly in detail dictate on what needs to be taught at the local school level. So, you know, they put that generic language in there to let the schools handle it however they like. But as a result, as you know, you remember from our survey, it showed, you know, we asked, you know, what does a unit of instruction mean at your school? And, you know, we had responses that go to, you know, it's one class period on one day, and that, you know, that's good for the year. And then others are lasting, you know, several weeks to a month of intense instruction about this. So obviously, depending on where you go to school and how your school treats it, is going to change the outcome for that student on how much they understand what's going on. So, you know, it's important to figure out what they, you know, what, how your school defines it and what they're doing with it. And so, yeah, and I've seen it in person as well. I mean, I've I've been the guest speaker in some high school classes about media literacy, and you know, in some classes, I'm like the only time they're going to talk about that. It lasted.
You were the unit of instruction.
Yes, I was the 45 minutes, and I was there, and I was gone, and never to be seen or heard from again. But you know, others will follow up with a few more class sessions or another few weeks, and I was just a small part of it. So it goes a lot of different ways, and like I said, there will be some follow-ups needed maybe down the road to see, you know, what are there different outcomes that we're noticing in different school districts based on what we know, if we can come up with some sort of a way to measure knowledge or aptitude in that area. I think it would be quite useful.
I suppose that there could be some kind of assessment for it, but it's, you know, like anything else, is challenging to do. But I do feel like the idea of, you know, like the general concept of media literacy, again, of better understanding and better being able to evaluate what is and is not reliable information, how to seek that out, and, you know, put things in context of why people are presenting information a certain way. That feels like something that across the board, you know, bipartisan, like, I feel like everyone would be like, yeah, social media is wild. Of course we need to do more of that. But again, once you get into the nitty-gritty of what that actually looks like, and even, I think even the phrase media literacy for some people evokes a certain thing that maybe they push back on. But just like when you really break down what it means, it feels like something that most people are generally for, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we would like to think it's politically neutral topic where, you know, everyone should have an interest in being able to understand what's true and what's not on the internet. But yeah, as you mentioned, it can be politically fraught as well, where, you know, the assumption comes in that, you know, if you say media literacy, you're maybe, you know, lifting up the, you know, we can just say it, you know, just lifting up the Democrat side and, you know, suppressing Republican voices is usually the typical way that the political chips fall on that topic. So, and that, again, it obscures what the purpose of the law is, and I think the objective of the law is, which is just to help people understand what's true and what's fake, and to encourage them not to share the garbage stuff and you know, highlight the stuff that's actually true and trustworthy.
I only have a couple questions for you left, which, again, one of them that we ask everyone who's on the show. This is a show that the idea is that everyone has had some kind of teacher who's inspired them, helped them become who they are today. For you, are there any names that immediately come to mind? Again, whether that be a teacher that you had K through 12, whether that be college, that could be an editor you had, you know, in your journalism career that you feel like taught you a lot. Could be a parent who taught you. Just like, who comes to mind when you think of that?
Yeah, I'm thinking, like I said earlier, when I went to Illinois Valley Community College, it's sort of when I got into journalism for the first time. I didn't work for my high school newspaper or anything like that. But, you know, my first journalism instructor at Illinois Valley Community College was a woman named Rose Marie Lynch. She had a, you know, a PhD in journalism, I think from Ball State University, which is, you know, you don't always see your community college professor in journalism have a PhD. And she was, you know, well respected. She was on the local high school board. She'd done a ton of things. But she also, she did this, and she was very encouraging to me. I you know, I wasn't sure if I could do this. You know, it's a new thing. It's, you know, I was a shy person by nature. So having me go out and interview people and ask them tough questions was a horrifying experience for me at the beginning.
It really is, I think, a learning curve for a lot of people in journalism, too. I remember being in college and having to go to an event to talk with some professor and just being terrified. Like, it's like cocktail party style. He's surrounded with people. They're wearing suits, and I have to walk up to him. I remember being terrified about it.
Yeah, and when I encounter students today, especially undergrads who have that phobia, I'm like, totally understand. But, you know, you got to rip the Band-Aid. You got to make the phone call. You got to interrupt the drink that they're having at the dinner party and just go for it. But yeah, I mean, Dr. Lynch, she was, you know, very pivotal in giving me some confidence that this is something that maybe I was good at. She put me in roles that maybe I wasn't quite ready for. And then she made me, you know, sports editor of the thing, of the student newspaper when I was, you know, very rookie, very young. And then I started writing new stuff and, you know, just very encouraging along the whole way, wrote me glowing letters of recommendation for as I moved up into other programs and other jobs. I haven't talked to her in a while. But this is a good reminder that maybe I need to send her an email and let her know how things are going.
Yeah. Do you feel like when you took this role that you're in now, was there a learning curve getting into the classroom?
Like I said, I did have experience with, teaching my own coworkers about how to use new things. And, also coincidentally, the previous director, Charlie Wheeler, always made it a habit to invite me back into his class, to speak to his class. I was, right. He's super old school and wasn't really up on all the latest gadgets and gizmos and latest tools,
sure,
technological tools out there to do journalism. So he'd bring me in to talk to the students about, those things, about what's happening in newsrooms. So I felt pretty comfortable standing up in front of a class. So that's been okay. I think when I started teaching undergraduates a few years ago, that was maybe a new thing. An undergraduate, as we mentioned, undergraduate students are more career focused. Undergraduates aren't sure what they're doing, either in the class or with just in life in general. So there's a lot more mentorship and a lot more grace, especially after COVID, sort of being there for them, to support them on a mental health basis and just to support their decisions that they make and, be graceful with them when they're late on an assignment because there's stuff going on in their life. And just, maybe be a little less of a hard person about it than maybe some of my college professors were back in the 90s when those mental health issues and considerations weren't as to the forefront as they are now.
Right. And then, most of the people who are listening to this are not journalists. And again, I think it is always helpful, like, demystifying the process and showing people how this type of work actually works. But is there something about teaching journalism you think is more important than people realize who don't do this stuff professionally?
Yes. I think we always like, we're the only profession mentioned in the Constitution, the whole First Amendment freedom of press thing. I'll sometimes, look at all the other programs and things that are available and funding decisions that are made at certain levels. And I'm like, how can you not want to give all the support you can to journalism? We're protecting democracy. We're protecting the First Amendment. And maybe I get a little in over my head and a little too cocky and boastful about those sorts of things because other people have value too, of course. I think, what we do is important. We're not the ones asking questions and holding government accountable. Who's going to do it? And I think, we've seen, especially over the last few years, just the importance of protecting democracy and holding power to account. And that's what journalists do every day. So I think it's pretty important. I'm glad I have a hand in teaching it. And, I hope I get to continue to do it for a long while.
All right, Jason. Thank you so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Did we start?
I think we're just getting started right
okay.
now.
Yeah.
I was just about to get to my sandwich fair questions, and that's when the real good stuff happens.
All right. Yeah, we're good.
That was Jason Pisha, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's really how we get all of our guests like Jason. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, please subscribe, leave us a rating, share it with a friend. If you like what we do, it really is the best way to get even more perspectives on the show. A big thanks to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of our show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin. This is Teacher's Lounge.